on the seductive power of the irrational. It must be very seductive because lots of people are being seduced. So we need to pay attention to this. Sometimes I feel like I'm living in medieval times. And I'm not talking about the faux medieval times in Orange County with the horses and the dinner and throwing the bones at people pretending to joust. I'm talking about medieval times of magical thinking and of superstition and falling away from the kind of thinking and reasoning and conversations that we all assumed were going to be a permanent part of our lives. I mentioned some weeks ago, and Fran was good enough to drop me a note in response to it, that I was absolutely shocked to find evolution back on the table, having seen Inherit the Wind 45 years ago in the movies. I thought those days were done and gone. And the great message, I'll jump to the end of the sermon in the beginning, always risky, but the great message is that enlightenments are great, but the flame has to be tended, or it goes out and we get dark ages. I remember going through Europe when I first went there as a very young man, looking at ruins and wondering, how did they let it go? How do great empires fall into disrepair? How do great systems of universities and of thinking and research and communication, how do they lose the light and fall back on what is really primitive superstition, magical thinking, and laziness? How is it conceivable that amongst political candidates, not all of them Republican and not all of them Southern, that if you ask, well, how many of you believe in evolution, you don't get a lot of hands coming up? How is that conceivable that seriously seeming people are presenting themselves to lead our communities, our state, and the United States itself, who basically reject settled science? How is it conceivable that we are not laughing hysterically or crying hysterically? One or both of those two things would seem to me to be the appropriate reaction to people just saying what is nonsense. Now, they have a reason. See, there's reason that's applied to irrationality, and I'll get to some of the other kind of Zen paradoxes in a little bit. But they have a reason. They say, well, look, evolution is just a theory, and there are incomplete parts to the theory, and if you don't understand everything in the theory, then the theory isn't proven, and you don't have to take it seriously. We haven't found the missing link. Well, yeah, they did, and it was in the mirror, and they can't acknowledge it. The missing link between the rational and the irrational. Now, look, this is not understanding, not simply evolution, sorry for the two negatives, not simply evolution, it's not understanding the word theory. It's only a theory, and if you don't understand something completely, then it can just be null and void however you feel about it that day. I don't think that's how the world works. The verification principle is everything is incompletely understood. Theories evolve. Proofs are offered, sometimes verified, sometimes rejected. They have the possibility of verification in principle. But everything we go by is incomplete. The theory of gravity is ill understood. It was only proposed in a recognizable form by a Unitarian, Newton, some several hundred years ago. It was refined by Einstein a little over 100 years ago, and it is still incomplete, and it is still only a theory, and it's subject to change. But my non-evolutionary friends and I when on the 40th floor of a building, will both choose the elevator and not the window. Even though gravity's only a theory, and we will also agree that the window is faster to our destination than the elevator. But we work all the time on incomplete mere theories. And so we pick and choose the theories that we're going to live by. Somebody says, well, look, it's a matter of my religious faith. And that takes it off of the table of reasoned discourse when we say, well, you know, I happen to believe. Well, I can happen to believe in just about anything. And to say, well, it's part of my religion, so I don't have to substantiate it. I don't have to talk reasonably about it. It's just something I carry around quite apart from everyday experience, is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. Most of our theologies are theologies of an irrational God who has very severe self-esteem issues and needs our worship and our praise and our obedience, or there'll be hell, literally, to pay. And that's nourishing somehow. What's the draw? Well, there is a draw. There is a draw to the idea that the world makes sense and there's order and pattern and it isn't simply chaos and phenomenon. And one of the problems that we have in having these discussions about the rational and the irrational is that science often leads us into mysterious places. And unreason and irrationality often lead us to places that are highly ordered and within their own tautological systems make perfect sense. If I'm a conspiracy buff, if I'm a religious fundamentalist of any kind, of any brand, then the world is ordered. The universe is operating according to somebody's or some entity's or some divinity's plan. And I might not know it, I might not understand it, but I can take comfort that it's not random chaos. Well, the Greeks did not invent reason, logic, and philosophy, but they should be given credit anyway, because they came very close to inventing all of these things. And the idea of science, of observing the world and seeing how things actually work, that's science. How do we talk about our lives and science and the world? That's logic, the analysis of our language. How do we celebrate the wowness, the that-ness of existence? That's religion. Religion is celebration. It isn't science. It isn't logic. It's much more akin to art than any of those things. When the Greeks came up, Aristotle specifically, with the basis of both mathematical logic and linguistic logic, the law of non-contradiction, something cannot be both the case and not the case at the same time. That is one of the ways that we advance the cause of how do we think, how do we analyze, how do we hand on information, and how can we sometimes discern truth from error, a true statement from a false statement. Niels Bohr, the nuclear physicist, opened up the doors to the problem with non-contradiction by saying the opposite of a true statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound statement may be another profound statement. And that's really important. Because what has happened in our modern world, in modern physics, and I don't want to go into the weeds on this, but I'm making a point about how science and reason evolve and maybe we can find our way back as a society, is our science has gotten much less specific. The theory of relativity changed an awful lot of things. And the idea of true and false as polar opposites, well, is the temperature in the room a good temperature? I can tell you, as somebody who stands here week after week and watches different people get up and walk towards the thermostats, some putting them up, some putting them down, and other people trying to tackle them on their way either to or from. At the university where I teach, they have the thermostats in a cage, but the people figured out how to open the cage, and so what the administration did was disconnect the thermostats. So they still get up and they push the buttons, but nothing happens. But it gives them a feeling of control and a feeling of participation. But that's the theory of relativity. It is not, things are not necessarily true and false. There is a fuzzy area for many of us. And fuzzy areas between reason and unreason. Fuzzy areas where it's not as clear. The Greeks and early physicists used to believe that if you knew where every particle was at the beginning of creation, you could predict the entire flow of history. And then came quantum physics and chaos theory. And my experience is that chaos theory is, at least in my life, correct. And that is, we can't predict every movement and every action and every reaction. Heisenberg pointed out that you can know that when you disperse a gas in a vacuum, it will be evenly distributed, but you can't know where any individual molecule will be, what it will bump into, and where it will end up. Life is an incomplete information problem, no matter how much information that we have. But what this has done is to create this strange paradox. Science seems sometimes to lead us to uncertainty. It seems to lead us to, well, we really don't know, and it's chaos, and this is an experiment, and our theories change, and the atom that the Greeks believed was indivisible, that's the original meaning of atom, now has more parts than there are elements, and science is always changing, but in uncertain times, in times of insecurity, religion and mystery and conspiracy and all those other things provide certainty, provide stability. If I can't, if I read just for me, and I pick up, what's the name of that organization, Health and Public Interest, and I find out what's going to kill me food-wise this week, and it's something different from what was going to kill me food-wise last week, I start going at some point, I don't care anymore. I'm not going to read it. I'm just going to have the Big Macs because the anxiety is worse than the calories and the sodium. I have a doc here saying, not nodding at me. But the anxiety could be almost as bad as the calories and the sodium. And when you see science, its virtue is being able to change, changing, and people say, well, no, 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 no. Give me that old-time religion. Give me something that is sure and certain. Give me a way that things were 50 years ago or 100 years ago when people knew their place, when we knew who we were in the universe, before Marx and Freud and Darwin attacked the gods and our proper place in the universe, maybe a couple of hundred years ago, before Galileo questioned whether or not we were really the center of the universe or just riders on a small dust mote at the edge of an undistinguished galaxy. And an even less distinguished solar system. You can understand the seductive nature of certainty. even if it doesn't make sense. It says, okay, things are as they should be. As a human being, as opposed to a clergy person, I consider myself to be both, but in my role as a human being, I have attended many funerals that I have not conducted. And I have heard clergy talk about, well, God needed another angel. God had a divine plan. This, everything works out for the best. I understand the comfort, but this is not how I experience the universe and not how I experience life. I can cry out in pain and bewilderment at what happens. Do I want explanations? Sure. Do I want to be certain of things? I'd like to be more certain of things. But the opposite of not being certain is not ignorance. It's just being less certain. And we have to be able to act with those gnawing fears that, and humility, that maybe I don't have it right. Maybe this picture in my head of how the world is or should be is wrong. Maybe I'm participating in a social action issue that 5 years from now I might not agree with. But my job is to live today. My job is to think today. My job is to be able to recognize science, to understand the attraction of the irrational, and to be able to try to figure out those strange border places. Perfect example of that's astrology. Astrology starts as a science, moves towards astronomy, then slips back away towards whatever astrology is. And, of course, being a Libra, I'm of two minds about the importance of astrology. But this was brought home to me yesterday as I was preparing this talk, when I thought about the first wedding ceremony I ever performed, and it was for a doctoral student named Larry Toy, who later became the head of the Foundation for California State Universities. For 27 years, Larry did that. And he wrote, and this was his preamble to his wedding, "In a universe whose size is beyond human imagining, where our world floats like a dust mote in the void of night, we've grown inconceivably lonely. We scan the stars, but the signs are uncertain. There is a path, but it appears to wander." We wander that path of phenomena, of stars. We look in the sky and know our small size. And we look at those great stars, those great fiery explosions in the sky, and see them as simple dots. Are they stars? Are they dots? We connect those dots in fanciful patterns. And so we see Orion's belt. We see Ursa Major's tail. We see the Pleiades. We see all kinds of things in the sky, and they are fanciful, and they are artistic, and they can be inspirational, and the stars are real, and we are real, and the patterns are ours. So when I think about reason and the irrational, I understand that I am a rational animal from time to time. I'm an irrational being at least as often as I'm rational. I have needs that I will call spiritual and artistic, beyond three hots and a cot. I don't want gray walls without art. I don't want life without music. I want those intangible things to come into my life and move me. I want the craziest of all things. I want love. That usually, my experience professionally as well as personally, is that love is not one of the more controllable, rational things that human beings experience and create and share. So we make this deal, living in several worlds. As a Unitarian Universalist, I take very seriously the words of someone I had not heard of when I had my bar mitzvah, which was not in this temple, but Mordecai Kaplan. And it really is the key to how I try to be a religious person and a social person in the world. And that is, our great job in modernity is tending the flame, making sure that it doesn't go out. And then Kaplan says, it is to take religion and spirituality seriously without ever having to take it literally. My first hobbies were mythology, Greek mythology and Roman mythology. I didn't get around to Norse mythology. I'm looking for Christina now. I didn't get around to Norse mythology till relatively later. When I quote scriptures here, I'm quoting the scriptures of culture and of humanity, of how people have wrestled with the great issues. I don't read scripture and think, that's the way it happened. This is the way we must be. They did it 2,000 years ago, so we got to do it now. I don't read it as history or science. I read it as human beings wrestling with the great questions of life, of death, and of what we do in between. While the light shines, while we can choose what to do and feel what we feel and moderate our irrational impulses with our rational minds and stay in a dialogue that has tension, because tension is how we keep our balance. It's why we have three branches of inefficient government in tension so one does not dominate. It's why we have art and logic. One cannot win a final victory, but we stay open with our eyes and our hearts, and most importantly, as the song says, bringing our minds to bear. Because ultimately, though all of our irrational impulses, not all, sorry, overstatement, many of our irrational impulses are to throw away responsibility, nonetheless, we have responsibility. Oedipus, when he begins to find out that he has married his mother, and he feels bad about this because he hadn't read Freud and found out that it was kind of a natural impulse, screams out, I thought that was a funnier line than you did, screams out that I am caught in the net of the gods. And Tiresias, the blind seer, says, no, Oedipus, you weave your own doom. Hamlet does the same thing. He goes, there's a divinity that shapes our ends. No, Hamlet, it is your character. Strangely, only Edmund, the bad guy in Lear, when given the opportunity to blame the stars, says, I should have been what I am had my bastardizing taken place under the maidenliest star of the firmament. We ultimately choose to be in dialogue with the rational and the irrational. We have the impulses, we have the needs, and we should not ever surrender. We are complex, rational and irrational people, and we can't choose the rational without acknowledging the seductive power of the certainty of the irrational. Of this, I am only relatively certain. You anticipated me on that.